You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You have my sword.
And you have my bow.
And my trowel.
Hey, it's Ash. Tilly and I are off on our own little odyssey, which means And My Trowel is taking a wee break. So here's something to keep you company in the meantime. I hope you enjoy this episode of Ethnosinology, and we'll be back with you soon.
Okay, welcome to episode 38 of Ethnosinology. I'm your host, Davian Howe. I'm an anthropologist and archaeologist, and I'm here with newly minted doctor. Well, I guess you were a doctor last time, but either way, Dr. Elise Cannon, expert in classical canine studies and the classical world, and also my favorite Australian friend. So how are you doing, by the way, Elise?
G'day. I'm good. I'm always putting on my best Australian accent for you. And I'm glad that I am your favorite Australian. Most people say, especially now with like Euphoria and stuff, everyone says like Jacob Elordi or like Margot Robbie. But I'm glad that I'm your favorite Aussie. That's good for me. That makes me feel good.
Yeah. I won't tell Maddie McAllister that.
But thank you.
What's that? Sorry.
It makes me feel good at 8:45 in the morning.
Oh, right. Yeah, you're in tomorrow. That's 4:46 p.m. here in the mountains. Yeah. Pretty cool. I also always forget like Margot Robbie and Chris Hemsworth and all them are Australian because they always play Americans. So I'm like, oh. And then you hear them speak in Australian, you're like, whoa.
I know. I was just watching all of the like extended versions of The Lord of the Rings last week.
Oh, yeah.
And there's just so many Aussies and Kiwis in it, which makes sense because Peter Jackson's from New Zealand and stuff. But like the whole cast, there's basically, I think there's maybe like two or three Americans in it. So
I think just Elijah Wood.
And Sean Astin.
And Viggo Mortensen. Oh, yeah. So definitely American.
Frodo and Sam. And yeah, Viggo, but he's like he lived in Argentina and he's like Danish.
That's right. He speaks Spanish like fluently. That explains why he's very good looking.
He's beautiful.
The guy who plays Jamie Lannister as well, Nikolai Coster-Waldau.
Yeah, Danish as well.
Extremely handsome man, also Danish. Yeah. Something going on there. Literally, though, he looks like it. So today, though, we're going to talk about dogs in popular media and culture and stuff. But I wanted to preface it with just let the audience know, because you've been on twice now. But last time we chatted, we were talking about dogs in the ancient classical world. Can you tell me a little bit about your research and what you were doing there? Because I just think it's fascinating.
Yeah. So I think when we last spoke, we're talking a lot about like dogs in war and like different breeds or types of dogs that were around, especially in like the classical Athenian period. And so my doctorate was covering different sorts of like functions that dogs had in ancient Greece, but specifically what the significance of those functions were and in terms of how they changed the lives and the emotions and the thoughts of the people who interacted with them. So I looked at like dogs as guard dogs and changing from like rural areas into like urban centers, how that affected how people understood what dogs, how they would behave and how you needed to treat them for them to protect you. I looked at dogs being used in philosophy, especially in the works of Diogenes, the Cynic, because cynicism is based on the Greek word kynikos, which is to be dog-like. And so I looked at how like behaving like a dog and playing the dog was a part of like living his philosophy in public, as opposed to just talking about it with small groups of students. So like demonstrating what his dog-like lifestyle would be. And then I also talked about the ways that dogs were increasingly conceptualized as pets or companion dogs. And that was through looking at like grave deposits of and mass grave burials during two rounds of the Athenian plague, where there were mass graves of adults and children and these little tiny vessels that children would use for their rite of passage, their initiation into Athenian life. And those vessels were painted with little dogs and children in all sorts of like realistic, playful and domestic scenes. So I was looking at how basically the core of it was like in all these different functions that dogs have in ancient Greek society and in their lives, how can the changes in those roles be seen as like driven by context, driven by what's happening to them historically? Are there things that we can observe that are directly linked to changing their political structure, changing what happens when they're in all of these like wars? And how do human and dog relationships kind of amplify what we can learn about those periods? So it was pretty fun.
I mean, yeah, it covers a lot and it's super fascinating. But I definitely want to ask you really quick, though. Cynicism comes from the word, like the root word dog, cynos or whatever. Why do you think dog behavior is associated with cynical behavior? Like, what's that link?
It's funny because, you know, our term for the way that we understand cynicism is, you know, someone who's a bit like, I don't know, a bit like non-believing, a bit more like questions things, or, you know, is a bit of a contrarian against the norm. And that is, I think, essentially what Diogenes the Cynic was doing. So when he was philosophizing, everything he did was outside. He was not in private spaces, in an academy, or in people's houses giving talks or discussing philosophy with young men. He was in the agora, in the public shopping spaces, doing some pretty wild stuff. A lot of it is pretty yucky. So he likes to go to the toilet in public, both ones and twos. And you can imagine what that would be like in, you know, like someone's going to a shopping plaza or a mall or whatever, because that's where everyone is, and just like sitting in the center of the food.
The guy shitting outside of an Abercrombie.
Just taking a dump because that's where he needed to go. He also pleasured himself publicly, which, you know, good for him, not here to kink shame, but that was something that he did. And he was also known probably the most, not just for his debauched antics, but for the way that he would like argue with people in public. So he was kind of like, you know, in The Simpsons, like there's the newspaper clipping of Grandpa and it's like old man yells at cloud.
Yells at cloud, like, yeah.
Diogenes kind of reminds me a bit of that, in that he would just kind of argue about anything, except he was so witty. Like there was nothing that you could say to him that he could not be offended. He could never be hurt. And he would always be able to turn what you said bad about him as something that was really a critique on you. And so how that is dog-like is that at the core of the cynic lifestyle back then was questioning what it is that society does, those unspoken rules that determine your behavior in public, and how that actually removes you from your natural instincts, both as a human, but also as an animal. So I always thought that was really interesting, that he, if people were disgusted by the things that he did, or they did say negative things to him about being a cantankerous old man or whatever, the fact that he could throw it back on them was always a way to show them, like, well, you only think this because you've been conditioned to think this way. So what does that say about you if you're so offended by me? And why can't you think for yourself about what it is to be a human, what it is to be in this city versus other cities, and why we can't have these conversations? So that's the more like the retorts and like the sharp barbs back at people was seen as a form of barking. The like living in public, going to the toilet in public, that is dog-like as well. But all of that is to show like dogs don't know hierarchy. They don't recognize that sort of these sort of like human structures, social structures that we have. They just exist. So humans can also become more than human, or more human in general, by behaving and understanding that they too are animals.
Which I think is pretty cool. Or at least like state level, you know, human hierarchies and things like that. They don't get taxes.
They have no idea. They are just not bothered.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. I didn't really think about that. Okay. Like cynicism and dogs is similar. And then you had mentioned the Athenian plague. But I think the last time we chatted something about when that plague happened, that's when you saw more dog like motifs and artifacts and paintings.
Yeah, definitely these like tiny little white fluffy dogs. They start becoming a bit more common around like 500 BC, but then there's like two waves of this Athenian plague that basically just like decimates the whole population. And Athens is also in the middle of a war, this very long war at the time. So if it's not like grain shortages or, you know, sieges, land and at sea, then it's this plague that's just wreaking havoc and like poisoning the water. It's spreading really quickly.
This would have been the Peloponnesian War, sorry.
The Peloponnesian War, yeah. So it's just, it's everywhere. And Thucydides, the historian who kind of, he tries to explain like the pathology of it, describing like the symptoms and things, but there's no, I think like epidemiologists and stuff have tried to understand what this sort of virus was for such a long time, but it's so hard with someone that's writing about it in ancient Greek, and Thucydides has his own writing style. So it's hard to know like what is accurate, what's not. Also, lots of people might have different types of symptoms and prevalence of symptoms at different times. But basically, because of this, it's just Athens is just a disaster zone. And out of that, you start seeing changes in the ways that people have to bury their loved ones, because the death rate, the mortality rate is getting so high. People have to like share funeral pyres instead of having one funeral pyre per person, because people just can't afford it. It's not time efficient. So, and you're also getting more like mass burials and things, which is just not really practiced, only in times of like genuine like chaos. And in those mass burials and things, you start to see some skeletons of children, because Thucydides says like, this plague like just struck indiscriminately. It didn't matter if you were young or old, rich or poor, whatever. And so you start seeing children in these burials alongside these tiny little vessels, like these little ancient Athenian like sippy cup or like little poppers, like I don't know, pop top drinks. But they're little ceramic vessels that children would have had their first taste of wine from, as like an initiation into becoming, you know, part of their like local fraternity, especially for boys, like their fratry is their version of like a fraternity. And so children are getting buried with those, and on those little vessels are very specific scenes of these tiny little white dogs that are playing with children. Sometimes the children are like dangling out some food for them. Sometimes they're running with a ball, or they're chasing them, or they're jumping up at them. So they're very like cute, like domestic scenes of children playing with dogs. And up until that point, that just wasn't something that you would see on vessels, like these sort of domestic scenes and like the realism with which the children were being painted, like physically. So without that plague, you wouldn't have this shift in like a painterly style, and you wouldn't have this increase in domestic scenes that allows us to see these little dogs being in the house as well. So it's kind of a way, it kind of embodies my approach to dogs in history anyway, where it's like you can see from these historical moments how the relationship changed, and then how it changed in terms of how it was represented. So if you didn't have that historical causation, you wouldn't know that this relationship existed, and vice versa. So like how humans and dogs throughout history impact one another, and what we can learn from it, and how people also consumed like these images of dogs. Like people clearly wanted these dogs like on these vessels. They wanted to go and see plays where people were being portrayed as dogs, and they wanted to see dogs on murals as part of their like the media that they consumed at the time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so jealous, one, because we just have bones and stones here. Like I can't, there's no, I guess there's some Mississippian pottery with dogs on it and stuff like that. But earlier on those hunter-gatherer societies, there's nothing. So we just have to interpret it through bones and genetics and assume the dogs are there. But to see it painted on that is like just so cool. But also, yeah, not to say it's like COVID dogs, like they all got dogs during the plague or something like that. But like, do you think it's a psychopomp thing where they're putting like the dogs associated with the dying children? Or is it just that the dogs, you know, it shows merriment and joy in the kids' lives, and that's why it's on there?
Oh, look, like with all pottery, painted pottery, you could interpret it in so many different ways. And dogs definitely, you know, like obviously through like Cerberus and guard dogs, they were definitely associated with the underworld and transitioning from life to death. I kind of thought it would be really funny if these tiny little fluffy white dogs became some sort of like underworld minion.
Yeah.
Like how like Hagrid's dog in Harry Potter was called Fluffy, even though it's like this
was Cerberus, wasn't it?
Beast.
Like, yeah.
So yeah. I remember thinking, you know, yes, of course there's the dogs and mortality and the underworld links. But those dogs are generally like these sort of hybrid, like Cerberus forms, like multi-headed and things, or they're the big, like Molossus, like Mastiff type dogs. So yeah, a little fluffy white dog could be a cool little psychopomp. And it might very well have been that, like the kiddies version, like a baby puppy Cerberus vibe.
Yeah.
But it's hard to tell. It's just all we can say is that at this time, this shift in iconography happened to like occur at the same time as these plagues and all these kids dying. And if anything, I feel like it shows a shift in what people were interested in having these vessels for, especially because they were intended for this like very specific ritual called the Anthesteria, which happened in February. And it was like a 3-day festival of like opening new wine bats. And it was also very associated with like purging the souls of the dead. Like they would kind of wander around the city at night and then be flushed out as the new wine jugs and vats were being opened. So there's already, even within that one festival, like so many different layers of like life and death and rebirth. And so if these children were using these vessels at this festival as part of their rite of passage and trying this wine as an initiation into the next phase of their lives, maybe if they didn't reach that phase because they died from the plague earlier, or they reached that phase and then passed away, it's still, that vessel has then taken on its own new meaning in that it's now in situ in that burial context, despite that it might have had that ritual context intended. So we just don't know, obviously, but the great thing about the pottery is that you can interpret it in so many different like life and death and rebirth kind of ways, like even based on where it was found and what is on it can give you so many different reads.
Yeah, we need to co-author a book on all this, just like you're the Grease chapter, or just you do your own book, but like there's so much cool information there. That's just so interesting.
One day.
Well, any day for you, I think. You got tons of knowledge on this stuff. But we had talked earlier and before about Argos and like dogs, you know, popular dogs in history. That's probably the most famous dog in ancient history that I could think of after, you know, the statues you'd see, or I guess Cerberus and Anubis. But with that, I would like to dive into that. But let's do a quick commercial break really quick, and we'll be right back. Okay, and we're back with episode 38 of Ethnocynology with Dr. Elise Cannon. I'd asked you before we took a break about Argos. Can you just, I mean, obviously the Odyssey is big in people's minds right now. So can I just have you explain Argos, and then we can go into like, you know, Futurama and stuff too?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a similar story.
Oh, what a story. I feel like it's the archetype of the loyal dog that has kind of just permeated throughout every single culture. I feel like all cultures have at least one story about a dog that kind of went above and beyond in showing its loyalty to man. And Argos is definitely my favorite, I think. And I feel like he's going to become big in the next like month, especially because like Nolan's Odyssey is coming out, and that's already causing a lot of interesting debate in general. But I watched the trailer and I was really excited to see that there were two little cut scenes of a dog. One was as a puppy. So I hope that's Argus as a puppy. I would imagine. So but it's kind of like this spot. The puppy kind of looks like a spotted, like a German pointer-ish kind of dog. And then the scene straight after, if you watch the trailer, is then this older dog. And it looks more like a Mastiff cross sort of deerhound vibe, which is kind of what I imagined Argos to look like.
So he's Cerberus mean like spotted, I think, or something like that, or spot. Like that. I think I saw that on like a meme or something that he means like spot headed or something. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I detract.
No, leave that with me. I'm so much of like ancient Greek texts when they're talking about dogs. Yeah, they tend to describe them like via sort of vague physical characteristics. Yeah, spotted. Cool.
Okay, yeah, that's cool. Or flesh devouring, depending on your translation.
Yeah, see, I'm always for a bit more like chomp energy, because there's lots of like different ways of whether or not he's got like 3 heads or 50 heads or 100 heads, depending on who's describing him at the time. But I like that with Argus, he is, for those that might not know the story, he was Odysseus's dog. That sounded strange, Odysseus's. My Australian accent is just not good with the, never been good with the Greek in general, ancient or modern. So what happens is that Argus originally is Odysseus's like little puppy. And so in Homer's The Odyssey, there is, I think, about 40 or so lines of this epic dedicated to sort of this like biography of Argus, the dog. And it occurs quite late in the work because it's when Odysseus has finally arrived back in Ithaca. And so he's in disguise because Ithaca has been overrun by all the potential suitors of his wife, Penelope. And so Odysseus kind of has to sneak in order that they don't kill him on sight to try and take his throne. And right. So he's walking up with this farmer, Eumaeus, and he sees this dog kind of on the outskirts of the castle, of the palace, laying in a pile of dung. And he's covered in flies and ticks, and he's clearly a really old dog. And Odysseus asks Eumaeus, the farmer who's leading him in, who is this dog? Like, why is he out here covered in feces, and why does he look so awful? And Eumaeus says that this was once the dog, this is Argos, like the stout, the strong-hearted, like the loyal. He was once the dog of Odysseus, and the whole town would like see how fast he would run, how amazing he was at catching rabbits, and he was the best of all dogs. But now no one looks after him anymore, and it's been 20 years and he's just sitting here. And Odysseus is really like taken by this because it kind of becomes this like metaphor for everything that he left behind and how long he's mm-hmm. been away and what's happened to Ithaca without him there. It's become like this once most beautiful and most effective hunting dog has now become a mess, so neglected, so unloved, just like the people and his household is now. And so because Odysseus is cloaked, no one knows who he is. So if he reveals himself to his dog, chances are someone will recognize that it's him. And so it's really sad. I always get a bit emotional. And I think even in the movie, it's going to make me, like, I'm going to watch The Odyssey at the cinema and I'm probably going to cry like a baby, not at anything else, just at the dog. Because what happens is that Argos is 20 years old, so he is ancient. He has seen some stuff. And the only thing that's kept him alive is, like, waiting in the hope that he will see Odysseus again. And even though Odysseus is in disguise, Argus still knows that it's him. And the way it's described is that he flattens his ears and he wags his tail. So clearly he recognizes him. And right. Odysseus starts to well up, but he knows that he can't engage with him. And so he walks past. And then Argos puts his head down and he dies. So.
Big bummer.
Yeah. It is absolutely brutal, but it, for me, it says so much about what was happening to Ithaca. But also, if we think about how these poems, how these epics were actually performed, they weren't performed in one long go, right? Because they're epics. Mm-hmm. So you would have these traveling bards going around to all different communities in Greece and singing songs from these epic cycles, like from this, these myths. And so that Argos scene is one of those, of the Odysseus, like returning, the homecoming. And I can't even imagine, like, for the people who would be sitting around listening to this part of the epic put to music, you'd be so, like, sad.
Yeah, in like, the Bronze Age, like so long ago.
Like, imagine you're having a bit of a drinking party and someone's like, oh, I'm going to sing about that dog that died. You'd be like, oh, damn, I guess it, you know, last drinks. Yeah. Like, I better go home. It also tells you, like, what people wanted to have, what they wanted to listen to, because you imagine it like, oh, tell us the story, sing us the story of Odysseus seeing Argos, like sing us the story of Odysseus and Circe together. And the bard would, you know, invoke the muse and then sing about this story. Like, people wanted to know this stuff, and they were able, I think, to conceptualize what Argos meant for the whole story of the Odyssey as being this sort of culmination of what the journey actually meant for the city itself and for Odysseus's household. So I'm keen to see how it plays out in the film, because I saw the Ralph Fiennes film, The Return, based on, so it's That's Odysseus right. returning. It's just that book. And I loved it. I thought it was excellent. But the dog Argos is just in it for, oh, I don't know, about 15 seconds. And I was in the movies. I was the only person at the cinema. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that bloody dog came up, I was like,
yeah, I didn't see that one. But I remember, I think you posted a clip about it. But yeah, it's Ralph Fiennes that he's talking to the dog at the end. I would also be sad too. And I go to the theater by myself a lot. It's way more fun. And like, you just middle of the day, it's just you enjoying the movie. But what I was going to say is I open up my classical world chapter with Argos, because I'm like, it's probably the most recognizable dog, and like obviously Anubis too. But I found it fun, or not fun, I found it interesting, I should say, and sad that, like, so the whole theme of the book is dogs are, you know, tie us to nature, but they're also like death symbols in a way, like with Anubis and Cerberus and all that. So the most famous dog it's sung about in this epic poem, written, or not written, but told by a blind man 3,000 years ago, like, as soon as you see the dog, it dies. So, like, they're always associated with, like, death in some way, or some kind of acceptance or grief, or, and it's probably a metaphor because he's been gone so long, it's back, and, like, his old life is dying and gone.
Yeah.
So, it's just very powerful. Like, so I start with that, and I'm like, all right, well, that's sad. Let's go to China. And then, like, I'm talking about, like, food dogs in China and stuff. But, it's interesting. And then I think what we're going to talk about too is, like, in a lot of movies, and I end the book with, like, dogs in apocalypse stories, like I Am Legend and The Road and stuff. Like, the dog is always a weird moral, I shouldn't say weird, but an interesting moral anchor in the story. Like, you know, the people aren't cannibals if they have a dog. They would have eaten the dog. Or they're good people. You can trust them if they have a dog. And then in I Am Legend, which we get into, it's like, in The Martian, Matt Damon's talking to, like, a camera, like a video. He's vlogging. So that's how, it's not just him talking to himself. But with I Am Legend, it's this interesting plot device where he's talking to a dog. So he can still be the last man on Earth, but he has a dog. But then you're like, this dog's going to die. And, like, it's just like that motif has lasted for 3,000 years. It's very interesting. Yeah. So I'll stop yapping. But, yeah, where did you want to go with this? Or if you have any comments on that, sorry.
I feel like the dog always has to die for the, you know, the moral of the story to be told. Like, especially something like a dog like Argos, I feel like we, as a society, as societies in general, maybe just as humans, there is so much like the depth of our emotions, we can't adequately portray them through a human actor. The extent of it can only ever really be portrayed like through an animal, like a dog. You know, like I'm one of those people in movies, like if a human dies, unless I'm like really attached to them as a character, if they're like Ned Stark or something, then I don't really care. I'm like, oh, okay, well, yeah, that sucks for the, like the narrative, I understand. But when it's any animal, and if it's especially a dog, I'm like, how dare you? That's why there is a whole website called Does the Dog Die? So that people can check a film to see if the dog dies before, because they might not want to go and watch it if so, because I know there is a generation of people who are traumatized by Marley and Me, who are traumatized by Hachi, a dog's tale. You know, and because these stories, they're like, they convey like a depth of emotion that we just cannot do through human actors. And I love that because it kind of shows how our emotions go beyond like ourselves as well. Like we can connect so much with, like the most amazing thing about humans is that we can forge an emotional connection with almost anything. But the deepest part of that connection is with dogs, I feel anyway. Because they reflect so much about ourselves and so much what we think we should do or ought to do as well. And so there'd be no other way to effectively like demonstrate the impact of coming home like that as Argos does.
That's really well put. Like it, yeah. And I say this often too, but like since we're primates and we're social mammals that have to be in groups and have connection and physical touch with others, especially like lately where it's all long distance. Like, I mean, I've never met you in person. You're through, not that I'm trying to, you know, stroke your hair or something, but like when you have, sorry, that was weird. But when you have a dog, it's like you have a physical animal that you can touch and groom and pet and do that with. Or even if you're, say, in a long distance relationship, or even if you're, you know, you live in separate houses and you're just calling on the phone at the end of the day, you're still talking over the phone, but a dog is 2D, like, or 3D. It's always here. You can't talk to it through a phone. You have to physically touch it and give it food, and it anchors you in that sense. And it's very
interesting. I feel like the nonverbal aspects of it are really important in terms of, yes, like we have words that we use to communicate certain commands and things, or, you know, sometimes I'm baby talking like my friend's dogs and stuff because I want it to give me kisses, and it will know by the like pitch of my voice, like, or how close my face is to it that I want kisses. And they have their own way of communicating with us, but it's not this equalized form of language that we can use to communicate. I often wish, you know, like my friend's dogs had phones so I could text them and like see what they're up to and stuff.
Yeah. What's up?
But I feel like because there's that gap, that makes the nonverbal, like emotional impacts of the relationship so much stronger. And I think that's why we can convey that depth of emotion, because it's not words, it's just pure emotion through animals, which anyone can feel. Like if you have a heart, you will feel it. You don't have to articulate it verbally, you can just feel it. And I think that's a nice way. And that's something that animals do bring out in people that can't be like rationalized away with words.
Yeah, not precisely. And like and this is just for me because I'm odd, but like I'm very extroverted at times. I'm like whatever that the third tier of that is, where I'm not introverted or extroverted, but I'm selective with it.
Yeah, same. 'Cause I'm,
podcast, yeah. And I talk all day, but then when I'm not doing that, I'm just like quiet and by myself. And that's my, like, I don't want to mess with. But that said, if I'm at a party, I'm able to talk to people. And when I was younger, I was very socially awkward. Now I can talk to people and that's fine. But if there is a dog there, I gun for the dog, because not only is it a conversation starter and you could be like, oh, like what kind of dog? How'd you get him? But like, it's just immediately something that I can socialize with. I understand it. I don't know these people's backgrounds, but I know how to talk to this dog. And then
absolutely.
I think that's pretty cross-cultural for people. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I went out with my parents and their group of friends. So everyone's in their 70s and we're on this like steamboat on the weekend and the captain had a dog. So what did I do? Before I went and talked to all of the lovely people that my parents were with, I hung out with the sailor dog for a bit because it's just like, it's also a way for me to like regulate my emotions before getting into a new social situation. I can be like, oh, cool. If there's a dog, yeah, I'm comfortable. Great. Now I can go and have these chats.
Yeah. It's like a bridge, but to like social bridge in that sense. Yeah.
I know like a cognitive and emotional bridge for us, like weird brain people as well. We need there to be like a dog there so we feel more comfortable.
Yeah. Or at the very least, if I'm like, I'm completely checked out socially after socializing for 10 minutes and be like, oh, what do you do? Where are you from? I go right to the dog because it's like, it's just like a recharge and like, all right, I'm going to hang out with the dog. Okay, so we'll do a commercial break here, but let's, when we get back, we'll talk about more dogs and popular media. But I'm loving this combo. This is cool. All right, we'll be right back with a commercial break. And we're back with episode 38 of Ethnocynology. I'm here with Dr. Elise Cannon. We're talking about sad stuff with dying dogs in Greek mythologies. So we had talked a little bit about Seymour. Is it Seymour Butts? Seymour?
Seymour Asses or Seymour Asses. That's my American accent.
Very good American accent, by the way. So for those unfamiliar, that's the dog from Futurama. But yeah, can I just have you paint the scene? Because I've seen this on clips, but I've never watched the full episode, though I do love Futurama when I have seen it. But yeah, can you?
It is the one episode that I struggle the most with in television history. I watch a lot of like really intense stuff and there's a lot of like memorable deaths in every show that I've ever watched. But Seymour Asses just destroyed me. That sounds like really inappropriate, but it's a dog.
No. Emotionally, sure.
So in Futurama, he is Fry's dog in the 1990s. In that, like, he's kind of this dog that follows Fry around at the pizza shop and is always sitting for him, like, to say hello after his shift. So for me, it's not clear if it's his actual, like, pet dog or if it's, like, a stray that he's kind of bonded with. So when Fry goes into the future, he, in this episode, he realizes that he never got to say goodbye to Seymour. And so he time travels back just to kind of see what he was like. And he toys with the idea of like cryo freezing Seymour and bringing him to the future with him. But this montage plays and it's like basically Seymour to Fry looks like he's gone and had a really nice life without him. And so Fry's like, oh, well, I won't bring him into the future because he was okay. And so he doesn't. But then the cut scene, which destroys me, Fry doesn't realize that Seymour actually went to the pizza shop every day and waited for him in like the cold and the snow. And that's where he passed away. So for in the narrative of the cartoon, it's implied that, yeah, Fry never knows that Seymour waits and Seymour never knows that Fry came back for him. Seymour never knew what happened to Fry. He just knew that if he went there, maybe he'd see him again. And that is, you know, Hachi, the Akita in that waits at the train station that they've made a couple of movies on, which also destroy me and I cannot watch. Because they're
I didn't
like,
add him to the book. I need, should have done that. Sorry.
Oh, it's amazing.
I know. That's like the most known dog loyalty story. Anyway, I'll let you continue.
And I think that's it's a specific type of dog loyalty that us humans, like we valorize it because we could never, we would never give up like shelter, food, comfort for something that we don't know will come back just in that present moment. That's what we know the dog knows they have to do in order to get that reward of seeing their person again. And so those tales of like dog loyalty, like Argos, like Seymour, like Hutchie, like Greyfriars Bobby in Scotland, they are just dogs that do beyond human displays of loyalty that we just love so much because we can't do it ourselves.
What was that last one you mentioned in Scotland?
Greyfriars Bobby. So it's a story about this dog in Edinburgh who waits at his owner's gravesite in like the main Edinburgh cemetery. And he has a little, if you go to Edinburgh, they've got a statue of him. You can go and give him
a pat. My friend just posted a picture today touching the dog's nose when she was in Scotland. Okay.
It's very special. It's very special. There's lots of competing narratives about Bobby, and that maybe he also liked hanging out in the cemetery because there were some decaying snacks he could eat. But the general story is that people knew him to always be sat at his owner's gravesite until he died as well.
That's a bummer and sad. But it is interesting because part of the central thesis of my book is like, okay, yes, these dogs are associated with death, like Anubis and Cerberus and all that. But like, but why is that cross-cultural? And like, if you want to go the Atlantean route and be like, oh, they people were in contact and like the Mexicans and the Egyptians, like, you know, contacted or something. But no, I think like in the Aztec creation story, Quetzalcoatl and Xolotl go down to the underworld to get bones to make people out of from the Mictlantecuhtli, is the god of the dead. And that's where all the bones were from trying to make different iterations of people first. But it's interesting that Quetzalcoatl, his brother, is a dog, and he has to go find human bones to make people out of. So whether that means, you know, the that they weren't big until 1400 AD or CE, so they had no connection to Egyptians. But I think it's just that with Anubis, like the jackals, and Cerberus being the underworld guardian, it's like dogs associate scavenging with bones, which comes from domestication, which is where that probably stems from in our psyche. But also it's the loyalty aspect, that they are so loyal and they love us, and then they die relatively quickly versus people in our lives. So you learn about death four or five times. Like, your mom and dad are only going to die once, but you'll have four or five dogs that die before then. So I mean, if you're having the standard lifestyle, you know.
Yes.
So, and that's something interesting. I don't know.
No, I love that, because it's thinking about, I know with, you know, with like ancient Greek religion and myth, there are certain like deities who are associated with dogs. And one is Hecate, who guards like the crossroads. So like intersections and stuff in pathways. And crossroads are also notoriously associated with death in the afterlife, not knowing what's coming around the corner, like death could be lurking, sort of thing. And so one of her sort of sigils are dogs as well. And she was many-headed, like three-headed, to look all these different ways. And sometimes people would offer her, like, sacrifice puppies to her and things. And the barking of dogs would herald that Hecate was near. So thinking about that sort of, like, evolutionary aspect, like trying to make that connection of a dog's bark would alert people to some potential danger. And a side effect of danger could mean death. And so kind of that trickling down, I think, is really interesting. And then how it impacts different cultural myths around dogs and death as well. Like, they're able to alert you to the things that are there just in case it might kill you.
That's fascinating too. And I get, Romulus and Remus are left to die, but they're saved by a wolf, which is interesting too. It's a little different, but it's similar. Yeah, that's fascinating. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to what it is, but like I guess you found that too.
Oh, there's so many like canine associations with death from, you know, like, like heralding, like signifying death, or carrying like souls to the underworld, or dragging souls to the underworld. And then with Cerberus guarding the gates of the underworld so they can't leave, to also the idea that a dog could be like your guardian on that journey as well, like your companion as like a comfort on the way, I think is really interesting. Familiar. Familiar. That's a nice way of putting it. Like something that makes it easier to bear while alive and dying, or with the prospect of dying, knowing that you'll be accompanied on that unknown journey, I think is very cool as well, by something that is known to you.
So it might be a part of the reason those little white dogs are on the pottery with the children. That's so
exactly.
cool.
Exactly. And it's a cute one, too.
It is a cute one. Did you watch Lost? I feel like we've talked about this.
I've watched a couple of seasons, but not enough.
I'm going to spoil it because it's been out for 10 years, 20 years now.
Yeah,
but the opening scene of the show, Dr. Jack wakes up in the jungle after the plane crash, and the first thing he sees is Vincent barking, the dog. It comes and wakes him up. And the last episode of the show is Jack dying in that same spot in the jungle and his eyes close. And as he's dying, Vincent runs up and lays next to him as he dies. And that's what breaks me. I might cry thinking about it. But for all the hate Lost got for its crazy writing, that was poetic as hell. And I loved that. Sorry.
And like, that's, those sorts of relationships are poetic. Like, for me, they're never cheesy. They're always like, they're bringing some sort of like closure. Like the, like Sam or Samantha in I Am Legend, we were going to talk about as well. Like,
yeah,
that dog is the whole point of that movie for me, because she conveys every single aspect of civilization that's been lost. She's his only, like Neville, like Will Smith's only contact. She's the only thing that gives him like a sense that he is still human. And when he, spoiler alert as well, when she must die, it literally drives him to madness, because yeah. And then that closes off like his actions to end the film, because without her death, it just wouldn't have happened that way. And with her death is the death of like any last like tie that he had to this like mortal civilized space that he called in his past. Like, she's the film.
Yeah.
She's called, like, I Am Sam, but without Sean Penn going full.
I was just about to say that. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I don't remember if I said this on a podcast, I wrote it somewhere, but it's in my head. The way I phrased this before is like, in I Am Legend, he's like desperately trying to find a cure to save humanity and like cure these people. Yeah. But he only loses his humanity after he loses his dog, because he tries to kill himself and like pills and drives the car out of the pier and stuff. So it's a powerful motif. And I guess it's been around for 3,000. How old is the Odyssey? 3,000 years old? 2,000?
Oh, it's so old. It's like Bronze Age style. Like 750 BC-ish, but set in the Bronze Age. But I think that's the like something that I always try and come back to in my studies and in my research, as it is like, what is it about dogs that are technically like more than human, and how do we emotionally like process that, and how do we represent that, how do we consume that, and what does that say about us if we can't have human characters that convey that depth of emotion? It shows that we have it, but it just can't effectively be portrayed in any other way than this dog. And that's evolutionary. And like, that shows like joint domestication, all the sorts of things that you and I, you know, we sink our teeth into daily, but it just appears in so many different ways and aspects that you don't expect to see dogs. Like, I'm always really impressed when I see dogs in like politics and stuff, because you're a more humane politician if you have a dog, or a dog in the White House. If you don't have a dog, then it's like, what's going on? Yeah. Like, are you okay? Like, are you a psychopath? What does that mean about our democracy? And so they're kind of like, these dogs are like a litmus test for how much of a human, how much capacity for empathy and feeling that you actually have, if you can be kind to a dog, and a dog will live with you and love you as well.
That's a great point. Cause Trump doesn't have a dog, but the previous Obama's, Biden's, and well, Biden's dogs bit everybody, but Obama had a dog, Bush had a dog. Major. That was right.
That's the first one in over 100 years not to have any sort of pet in the White House.
Is it really 100 years?
Yes.
That's wild.
Yes. I gave a paper on this very topic.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I was going to bring up too, like Putin, I remember he brought his dog to to intimidate Angela Merkel. So you can use dogs in that sense too, but that's sociopathic behavior, I think, but don't kill Putin.
Yeah. Sorry. That's the dog as an extension of his personality.
Right. But it does. If I like that Irish president, I think, I forget his name. Yes. He has his dog everywhere.
He has a Bernese mountain dog, or had a Bernese mountain dog.
Yeah. The black and white one.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, like the type of dog that people have is really interesting, which is why like I want to write this book about like different historical moments, like through these famous dogs, like Checkers and Nixon, amazing. and like what Chequers brought about. Oh yeah, Chequers and Watergate, that's a whole thing. The dog that helped bring down a presidency. But they're especially with like political readers. Yeah, you need to get onto Chequers, the dog, and learn a bit about Chequers. Okay, check that out too.
Definitely write this book.
Yeah, because they're so fascinating and there's so much you can learn about people by like the dogs that they have, all the dogs that they don't have. I remember when I was doing some research on, I'm writing this paper at the moment, and I was giving some talks on parallels between Athenian demagogues and how demagogues in today's society are presented by the media and things. And Trump is always an interesting example that historians will bring up and political commentators will bring up as being like, well, he doesn't have a dog. So what does that mean about him? And I think it's like, you know, when a politician, like they should be married and have kids for them to be taken, like, oh, you're a family man sort of thing. And if you're a woman that's unmarried in politics, right, like what does that say about you? And so for someone to not have a dog, if you Google like articles, like there was literally, I think there was a New York Times one that was like, why Donald Trump hates dogs and what this might mean for you. Fascinating. Because
really,
and the absence of the presence of a dog is taken to mean something. Like, so there's so much cool stuff that we pathologize and diagnose people based on the kind of dog or the kind of not dogs that they have and why.
Yeah. And even if he doesn't like them, or it's like, you know, if it's a sociopath or not or whatever, like it's still breaking with tradition in a sense too, which it still would take. Does take me off. Like a president should have a dog. Yeah.
Yeah. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. And some people just don't like dogs, or they have, you know, the fear of dogs, and that's okay. When they just actively dislike them, I'm very curious, because we know that, what that can mean, like diagnostically.
Yeah. It's rare that I meet a person that's like, I don't like dogs. I can't think of the last person I've met that has said that, but you can tell when people are afraid of them or don't like them.
Yeah, and that's okay. You might have had a traumatic experience or something. Like, that's totally fair. And honestly, sometimes
some
dogs are really scary.
Yeah, my dog was for sure. He scared a lot of people. But okay. Well, we need to wrap, but
yes.
I think you had a great closing statement, and then I interjected, but anything you want to close with? Any other ancient Greek stories or anything like that, or where people find you?
I think, because I've been thinking a lot about a lot of the discourse that's happening around like the Odyssey as a film in general, and the casting choices and things. And
yeah, Matt Damon's not Greek, so stop complaining.
I have fallen prey to some trolling with my own work and stuff, and that's okay. I'm always happy to have a chat with people about stuff, but I draw the line at just like, if you haven't read it, you need to or even just like read an abridged version. I don't know. I would rather we have a conversation based on whether or not you've engaged with the text that the film is being adapted from before just deciding that because people look a certain way, they can't be in the film. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is something that I feel like this is so much more prevalent now than it was like 20, 30 years ago in general. Like, no one had a problem that Russell Crowe was an Aussie playing Decimus and he couldn't even pronounce his surname correctly, like in the actual cut. No one had a problem with that. Like, no one had a problem with Commodus actually dying in the arena when he did not, that, you know, Marcus Aurelius didn't want him to be emperor. Like, he actually did. They co-ruled together. Like, people just kind of get to pick and choose what they want to be outraged about. And I feel like when we get any opportunity to see the ancient world on film, we just should be kind of grateful. There are some things in the new adaptation that, you know, maybe I might be like, oh, I wish they didn't do that. But again, I have not seen the film. So until I see the film, I will reserve any outrageous opinions I might have based on a trailer comprised of lots of different cutscenes. But I hope, my final thought, my hope is that Argos gets the screen time that he deserves.
We can only hope. And I will text you as soon as I see it and let you know
please.
If I cry
That's
too. Great. Well, Elise, thank you again. It's always a pleasure having you on. You're just a wealth of knowledge, and I could talk to you for literal hours, but you have to go to a conference. And you're in tomorrow. So Yeah, History Doggos. Is it still your same Instagram?
That's still my thing. I'm bad with it, but I want to try and do more. Hopefully now I'm medicated for my ADHD, I'll be able to be more present.
Yeah. Adderall gang. All right. Speaking of, this episode is sponsored by DMFedrick. I'm just kidding. It is sponsored by you and me. You go to fluent.pet/David to get my dog course. If you like my dog lecture, great. 3 hours of it on the course. It's easy enough. Fluent.pet/David. DavidHow.com for all your merch and stuff if you want that. And then please remember to rate and review the podcast. If you're on YouTube, hit subscribe. And please listen to anything else on the Archaeology Podcast Network. And yeah, Elise, thank you again. We'll catch you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.